I think number one, if you're listening to this podcast because you're interested, if you're kind of a tech hobbyist like me, and that's a safe place to be, where you acknowledge you just don't know everything. Number one, create the space to learn. And I always recommend find 25 or 30 minutes in your calendar or in your week and just decide to use a tool that's available. AI tools are showing up in any program. I mentioned, you know, baked into Messenger, it's baked into your Google Docs, it's baked into your Microsoft, it's baked into your Word search. Like, just try to use it.
Welcome to the Conversations on Applied AI podcast, where Justin Grammans and the team at Emerging Technologies North talk with experts in the fields of artificial intelligence and deep learning. In each episode, we cut through the hype and dive into how these technologies are being applied to real-world problems today. We hope that you find this episode educational and applicable to your industry and connect with us to learn more about our organization at appliedai.mn. Enjoy.
Welcome, everyone, to the Conversations on Applied AI podcast. Today, we're talking with Donna Herbel. Donna is the founder and chief igniter of Blue Phoenix Learning, where she provides speaking, training, coaching, and consulting services on the topics of leadership, using technology to streamline processes and improve communication, and talent development strategy. Additionally, she is the co-founder and COO of Savvy, where she works to advance Savvy's mission to provide employer-sponsored health insurance options to employees that are simple to understand and implement. Her purpose is to be a force for good, supporting individuals and organizations in achieving their most compelling goals. I love that purpose and mission, Donna. That's awesome. So thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Thrilled to be here, Justin. Thanks for the invitation.
All right. Sounds like you got a couple different things going on here with your Blue Phoenix Learning company. And then you're also sort of in the depths with a company that sounds to be doing some really cool stuff around employer-sponsored health insurance options, kind of bringing AI into that industry. And I know we'll talk about both of these, but oftentimes what I like to do is ask people, okay, cool, we know where you are today. Maybe draw us a sort of like a through line or like just maybe how you got to where you are today.
I love that. Thank you, Justin. So through line might be optimistic. It's a really spiraled path. So yeah. I come to where I am today very honestly. So I'll start, you know, the long backstory. Grew up in rural Midwest, where we are today. And in our teeny town, because of my mother's work in education for the state, we were one of the first families with a computer. So I grew up on Zork. That'll resonate with a couple of people, and a little game called Zaxxon. And so throughout my time, my parents owned a small A&W franchise when I was growing up. So time passes. The restaurant industry was my part-time job that accidentally became my career. So I worked for a couple of decades, specifically with Perkins Restaurants and overall throughout the hospitality industry with the Council of Hotel and Restaurant Trainers. Narrowly focused in education, which was corporate training, HR function, and then L&D. But my background in technology really was important through that time because I worked with a lot of systems development, systems implementation, and just like helping workforce use tools well so they could do, you know, 36-hour life in the 24-hour day by letting technology help them perform better, communicate better, be more efficient. So I call myself a tech hobbyist. I've been a tech hobbyist, and I took a step from that corporate learning and kind of started this second stage with Blue Phoenix Learning, which was meeting the need for technology training, leadership education for what's evolved into the new normal, where people are time poor. There's more information than you can possibly process. And as a result, it's really hard to get actionable insights and grow a relevant knowledge base. So Blue Phoenix Learning started some work that I've done for a couple of decades and translated that into coaching and consulting. And through that work, because I am a tech hobbyist, met Mary Margaret Irish with Savvy. She's got this big vision. We're actually having coffee and talking about how broken some of the healthcare selection systems were, as well as a conversation around how AI can really help companies and businesses solve complexity in a way that's never been available before. So that evolved into, hey, let's build something cool. And that's what we've been doing with Savvy. So like I said, it's a spiral, probably not a straight line, but hopefully that helps.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it sounds like, you know, I think it's interesting. You were talking about tools and tools for employees or just general people to use. And I was thinking like, yeah, no one really showed us how to use the internet. It was just like, okay, you know, you get this little disc from AOL, right? And you kind of dial up and everyone's just sort of figuring this out sort of like along the way. And like, how does email work? And what is a domain name? And, you know, there's no user manual for this. And I feel like today is just another, you know, repeat. And it's going to keep repeating with all sorts of new technology that comes out. Even the smartphone, for example, like no one knew what the App Store was to begin with. We were just kind of figuring it out. In fact, I even remember using the iPhone for the first time. And I was like, how do you actually turn this thing off? You know, and it was like, oh, you got to long press the button and then you get the swiper and all that sort of stuff. But it was like, there is no on and off button. So I just had to kind of figure out how to like learn that, you know, and of course, we all kind of figure this stuff out. So I think there's something there around like what you've been giving back with regards to teaching people. And I'm curious to know, like, maybe what were some of the first examples that you've been doing at Blue Phoenix Learning where you came into companies and said, you know, they're kind of like deer in the headlights. They're like, I don't know what I should be doing or not. How have you been kind of walking them through this?
Yeah, so great question. And what we frequently find is being able to have the safe conversation that says, where are we confident and where are we not confident? No one goes up to their boss and says, I don't really understand how we're using Microsoft Teams, or I don't know how we're using Google Workspaces.
Yeah,
or
right.
I just heard the company turned on Copilot. I don't know what to do with that, right? So there's kind of this disconnect between technology solutions and platforms that have been implemented, but not really baked into organizational processes. And so that's really where I work most. Like easy examples, the email inbox, which comes up a lot when I talk to senior leaders and when they say, look, we're kind of like, what could a technology solution look like? Well, when you look at how much of a work week is spent responding to calls for attention, because we haven't stopped to say, okay, we have an email solution, but here's when this company or this organization, these work teams use email. We have a chat channel. We have a Slack channel, or, you know, there's a variety of different channels. We have channels, but here's when you use channels. Mm. We have documents, and here's where the documents go so the team can use them. And there's this pause point of reflection. I sometimes challenge to say, just go back through the last week. How much time did you lose? How many meetings did you have where you couldn't actually get to action? Because people weren't prepared, didn't have the same information, weren't level set. How many times are you working late or taking emails and phone calls around dinner time or at kids' hockey games when that information could have been better constructed once instead of shared in 6 to 10 emails and messages? So we start with not only how should work work, but how is work currently working? And what we find with that is, there just isn't a common language for when do we communicate? How do we communicate? How does data get stored?
Mm-hmm.
And then when we back into different platforms, and this happens pretty frequently, when we'll have like an executive group, I can think back to one session we did, you know, the training team says it would be really great to use some of these AI tools because AI can do some really great stuff with cleaning up text, right? Or image generation, or just making templates really easy to use and easy to understand that are repeatable can save that workload. And of course, the marketing department says, well, we've owned Synthesia for over a year, which is one of the solutions that would do that. Well, there's just a talking point of, can we get an organization's teams to have a consistent language on the tools they're using? And really back into what are the problems we're solving? How should work work? And then what technology is currently in place? And sometimes we do a lot of training around that. People don't like to admit they don't know how
we're... That they've actually
had it? Yeah, that they've had it. And they're like, well, I looked at it, but I wasn't sure. So I just never used it. And then you have somebody else who's like, they've never been in the platform. Why aren't they checking their notes? Well, we can fix that. So... Yeah.
Well, who is your typical audience when you go in and talk with people? I mean, is it somebody from marketing? Is it somebody from sales? Is it somebody from leadership, the C-suite, or all of the above?
Yeah, it's usually C-suite. So generally what I find is, at least most recently, especially with the explosion of like the AI tools, here's what's available, how can it work? I've been doing a lot more work in lunch and learns or even half-day sessions with executive teams or leadership teams representing multiple departments, just helping everybody understand in one conversation, what are we talking about and what's possible and how could it work? And more specifically, how should it work? A lot of those conversations have been really siloed. And so there's enough curiosity where leaders want to be able to have more of a general dialogue and really talk about it through the filter of the common business. So and then I do some work with teams specifically. I do some training, hands-on training for individuals who just say, look, I know this is coming. I know I need to use it. I don't know how to use it. My organization doesn't have any training. Like I'm just here and I kind of go for it, but I don't even understand what it's supposed to do. And I'm being asked to do stuff with it. And so we'll do some really block and tackle on the keyboard. You know, let's analyze a few reports. Let's apply it literally in our day-to-day work. So those are the two buckets.
Yeah, that's great. And I'm assuming, there isn't like a one-size-fits-all, right? Probably each industry or each company kind of has more opportunities to use it.
Yeah, I think different organizations have a different tech history, right? When we talk about applied AI, there's some organizations that are very advanced because, Justin, as you know, and I always joke, you're my favorite futurist, but it's true. You've known for a long time that AI didn't just arrive. AI didn't just happen with the launch of ChatGPT. So when you talk to the IT department, even as an executive or a professional, you're like, I've got questions about AI. They're like, yeah, so do I. I've been doing this for a while. But that's not the same conversation. So what they're really saying is, there's these new tools that are work tools, and I want to talk about those, and there's this big disconnect. So sometimes that's part of the conversation too.
Yeah. Yeah, I started listening to this book on Audible called The Worlds I See, and it's by a woman named Fei-Fei Li. She was at Stanford and then was at Google, like one of the pioneers of AI. And, you know, the book's pretty long. Most of these books are like, 14 hours or so. I listen to them when I'm out running, but I listened to the first couple hours this morning. And it was about her history, about coming here as an immigrant, actually. So she came from China, and really, really interesting story about how she grew up there and how she ended up moving here. But what made me think about this was, she talked about the history of AI, right? And that, that there was actually a lot of work that was done in the 50s and in the 60s. And then machine learning kind of got this bad rap as actually like not the right way to do it. People were more around hand coding and expert systems, like sort of thought that that was the right way to go. So, you're right when you're saying like people are like, well, we've been doing this for a while. They definitely have been doing it for a while. There definitely are certain industries, I think, that are far more advanced around computer vision, for example, right? Autonomous, a lot of planes fly themselves, right? So there are a lot of things where we have a lot of these algorithms that have been sort of, put into practice. But I think the unique thing that kind of happened was like ChatGPT was like the killer app, it feels like. Like it's just democratized. Anybody could just sit down and start playing with it. And I think that was kind of a game changer. At least that was my opinion. Now, real quick too, as I will say, I actually had the guy who started a project called the AI Dungeon, and he actually was using GPT like 2. And I interviewed him here on the podcast, boy, probably 2021, maybe early on days. So it was funny. I was watching this sort of like get better and better over time. And I think, GPT-2 isn't that good actually. And it was just a matter of time though, how it's going to get better and better. And now, we're talking about 4 and we'll be talking about 5 and 6. Like, how do you see this? There's a sort of exponential sort of growth that's happening, in time. And again, like I say, people have been trying this for 50 years, but I think we've made more advancements in the past 15 months than we have in the past 50 years, it feels like. How are we talking to organizations about that?
Yeah, I think there's two things. So number one is you look to the future, the shift, the digital bridge, the technological bridge is getting a lot bigger. So you've got some early adopters who they experiment, right? They're interested. They've been on ChatGPT. And then you've got others who that's wonderfully interesting, but they don't actually use it or haven't used it or are now dabbling with it and don't have as much confidence. I was talking with one gentleman who, runs a really large team, and ChatGPT, he'd heard of it, but he was like, yeah, that's just a fad, until one of his employees started literally using ChatGPT to produce documents and reports and information in such a fast time. Yeah. Projects he thought would take days. All of a sudden, he's got this employee who's coming up like 10 minutes later with really good stuff. That was our conversation when he was like, I want to learn more. Can you help my team learn more? Because it's the famous, we have to do more with less.
Yeah.
We've got a lot more work that's a lot more detailed, fewer hands. And so we're trying to solve for capacity. And this feels like this could do it. So we actually went down, we did a training for the team. And part of that was just starting with some ideation, right? Be confident about using it. Where does it go from here? I hesitate to use the crystal ball. It's fun for me. I'm right as many times as I'm wrong, Justin. I think in the future, the big shift is going to be, one, organizations and companies have to decide what's their acceptable level of use. There was a lot of use with ChatGPT when it came on early. I talked with a lot of individual contributors early on. Even February 2023, I'd started doing some training in the L&D space, learning and development. And in short order, I started getting calls back from these trainers who said, hey, we know what we want to do. Like, we know the recipes. We know the standards of service. We feel like we can take this information and make it more easily accessible for end users faster than we ever have. Big upside. Except the company's concerned that our stuff isn't secure, and so we've been told not to use it. So I think, as we look forward, I think organizations that think they can dig their heels in and just not adopt or not put any kind of rules or processes in place, the reality is your people are probably using it and just not telling you. So I think that's one. So I think in the future case, it will be as assumed as being able to use email for work. Right? There were some industries that were slow adopters. I mean, there's still some who you literally have to send the fax. They won't take the email, which blows my brain up. And in the future, I think you get to that same place with different AI tools. This assumption that the work is better because people have put their time and attention into the minutiae, I think companies have to rethink that a little bit. I had a really interesting conversation with Damian Real, who's a local to the Minneapolis market as well. I think he was at the Applied AI conference as well.
Yeah, he's been on the podcast, actually.
Yeah, Damian, a big, big fan. Good guy.
Phenomenal. Yeah,
and it's great. I've known him for a long time. But one of the conversations we had early on was this idea of AI is really a 10x component. So people have to decide, do you want to 10x your impact in the same amount of time? Or do you want to put the same amount of impact at a tenth of the time, right? So I think businesses and employers are going to start to rethink the impact, productivity, and physical time equation when they introduce AI. Now, there's the second part of concern, like where does it go from here? There's a lot of concern about how does it impact employment and jobs? You know, there's a lot of citing of, I think it's the World Economic Forum 2020 report, which, by the way, was before ChatGPT even, that pointed to a loss of like 81 million jobs with AI. But most people missed in that was that same article pointed out an estimated growth of over 90 million new jobs. So it's not that work stops, it's that it happens differently. So where do I think it goes from here? I think it's important to inspire curiosity and dabble and learn it as it evolves, because it's evolving. And there's some risks and there's some rewards, and we don't know what's going to happen next. But it'll be interesting.
Yeah, I like how you mentioned about people using it and not telling you about it. I mean, it is like this thing in my back pocket that I use. And I also feel kind of weird, like, should I disclose or not? Like, so it was basically a statement of work for a client of ours, right? And so I cranked it out in just a fraction of the time, right? And sent it over to the team. They took a look at it and they were like, wow, you did this like that quickly? And I'm like, well, I use ChatGPT, right? I mean, so I kind of said under my breath. But the question is why not actually just be open about it, right? Now, it didn't do all of it. This is the other caveat that I love to tell people, you know, all these jobs are going to get lost or whatever. It gave me a good framework, right? And I was able to essentially sort of, I guess, enhance what I had already created, which, you know, I already have processes and templates in place and all that type of stuff. So I wasn't working at it from scratch, but it definitely was able to sort of help me frame it up and give a much more clear, concise, you know, body of text than I would have been able to do on my own. Or maybe not even better than if I would have been able to do on my own, but kind of like Damian was saying, just faster, right? I mean, I could have spent 6 hours on this. I ended up spending 16 minutes, right? It was just, I mean, an order of magnitude change. And that's what I think companies are going to need to sort of figure out. You're right. How much do they want to bring it in? Certainly, it should be a tool that you try and use. I think that's what you're saying.
Absolutely. Well, and I think the other part too is what we've learned is these tools can really help you do great work fast, but it doesn't do all the work. I was having a different conversation with an instructional designer who said, you know, do I even have a future in my career? I mean, I design learning events and maybe AI can do it better. And I think the answer is AI can do it different. But in my experience, looking at the outputs, they're not that great. Like literally, if all you want is a point of work that says, here's how to use the hand towel dispenser or what, right? Things that are so, ChatGPT can do a reasonably good job at that.
Right.
If you're looking for how do I meet a learner where they are, whether this is their first job or their 10th job, and help them understand how to build a personal connection with a family of four in the dining room of a restaurant, somebody has to help with the human side of that. So I think it does a great job for baseline, but I think those that can use this information, like you said, to do scope of work, to do work really well as a baseline, the biggest advantage that I've seen companies benefit from, and even individuals, is usually when we're doing project work, we have a window of time, right? If you're going to spend 6 hours, Justin, on a scope of work, if you spend 5 of those hours putting together the basic outline, the detail, the good to great, you've only got an hour left because you're on deadline. So if you put in that same 6 hours, but you use a tool to do what I call kind of the minutia work, that here's the outline, here's the format, here's the key things that have to be here, here's the stuff we all know that can be imported from a database, and you spend 4 or 5 hours, if you're going to spend that same amount of time, you spend that same 4 or 5 hours, you're really spending it on doing great work that's client-specific, high impact. And it's that polishing of good to great that I think just the cadence of work and the pace of time misses. And I think AI can solve that. And that's back to that conversation of, do you do 10 times the work or 10 times better in the same amount of time? It's really, what do you do with that time? Today, I don't know about the rest of our listeners, but I know personally, there are times when I've, you know, put work out into the world and I've known, man, if I could just have 2 more hours,
yeah,
I could format it so it looks better, or easier to navigate, or there's a couple of final enhancements that would make it really great, but I'm out of time and I got to move on. And I think that trade-off looks different when some of these AI tools, whether it's ChatGPT, whether it's Perplexity, whether it's Claude, I've worked with a lot of some of those different backends for different reasons. They all have different strengths and weaknesses, but being able to use the right tool at the right time out of the AI tools. And I add new tools to the tool belt every day. And some of them I'm like, that's a terrible tool. I take it back out. But having that tool belt just allows you to do your best work in the time allocated, which I think is probably the biggest benefit that I've seen organizations use initially.
Yeah. And we all have a limited time here, not only with projects and work, but limited time on this earth in some ways. If you just think of it at a more higher level, like how do we want to spend our time? We want to spend our time creating yet another template for something, or, you know, spend our time on the higher level tasks. And that's what I think it can be a net positive, right? I believe we can use this to get rid of some of the mundane things that we do. Are you seeing anything around generative like images at all? Are companies talking to you about images as well?
Yeah, I think, well, specifically on the L&D space, the ability to use image generation and in painting has been really, really valuable. So both image and then video generation. So the biggest benefits when we get into training and even communication, pictures are worth 1,000 words, right? And sometimes you're like, this is a great picture, this is a great video, this is a great training, this is a great demo, except when we shot it, the tools were different, except the colors were different. That would have been perfect, except Joe's in the background and Joe should not be in the background for where this is going. So that real practical application of how can I take like what I have and use it well. So that's kind of more of the in-painting image modification has been really helpful. It's also saved a lot of time when you have the video or even the stills that are good, but they're not quite right. And you're like, I do not want to haul everybody back on site and do a reshoot. Can we just move the eye contact, which is helpful. I think what's been fun and unexpected for image generation is that creativity and ideation, where people sit down and say, if I had to dream this thing, what would happen if I just threw all these words into an image generator and what would it come up with? And sometimes you think, that's really fascinating. And sometimes too, you get to see some of the way these processes put information together. I laugh a little bit. I use the example of the grilled cheese. I did some image generation of, I do that for demo when I'm training, like how do you even generate images, right? And we talk about how do you apply different types, right, to get different image outputs. And so I start with a simple, let's do a grilled cheese on a plate in a park. 9 out of 10 images will make a grilled cheese with lettuce on it because somehow it recognizes that a grilled cheese is a sandwich and it should have lettuce. Either I've never done grilled cheese sandwiches right and I've always skipped the lettuce, or that's right. Not how the world works, right? But that's an example of where some of this image generation can put some ideas together. You can get something really creative and you can look at it and be like, I wouldn't have thought of it that way, but what if I did, right?
Right.
So, yeah.
Right.
So I see image generation mostly in creativity and some recreational stuff. You know, I like to send people in Facebook Messenger their custom birthday cake. I'll always do like a /imagine. If you're ever in like Messenger where you can have it do some AI image generation, you know, send a birthday cake that features, you know, dolphins, seashells or whatever. And it can take some of that ideas. And I mean, that's just the fun stuff, but yeah.
Well, there's a lot of fun stuff, you know, involved for sure. And I think it was interesting. I was listening to a podcast a couple of weeks ago. They were talking about image generation and like, it was around the idea of basically saying that it's been AI generated, right? So there's this really worrisome thing that's going on right now, right? Around deep fakes, right? There's a lot of stuff in the news. Has been in the news, but this is going to be more and more, especially not only with the election year, but just the tools are just getting so much better that it's really, really hard for people to discern what is a fake and what's not. And so companies are starting to put in watermarks, right, to basically allow. But this person was talking about, I forget who it was, I'll have to go back and find it if I can again, but they were talking about this idea of like sometimes you just want the original image, right? Sometimes you actually just want it all, you know, with all of its imperfections, right? So imagine a digital SLR camera, you know, that basically took the picture and that's the way it is. And that, you know, you might want to add some AI to it. You know, you might want to change the light. You might want to improve the person's, you know, face, all this type of stuff, all the way to this other side of it. And so they gave a pretty good interesting thing about, as long as you're open to it, like, hey, I just applied something to this and I made something different, right? And so that's okay. Like the whole point of this was as long as you're open and transparent, and he believes that, you know, that there's, imagine it being like a slider of like a filter, and you're basically like, okay, you know, I want to add all this stuff in there. It's great. It's all about transparency, I guess, is kind of what that thought was, which I thought was an interesting scenario.
Yeah, I think there's two parts when it comes to this level of customization and modification that's now available with AI. And I'll kind of give a shout out. This is a super oldie but goodie. It's on my list of favorites from the 99% Invisible podcast, but it's super old. So I'm not, you know, pitching another podcast. But if you had the chance to check out, they did some great work on the ELIZA effect. And in that example, so the ELIZA effect, for those that aren't familiar, when I train on just AI and computer systems in general, I think we have to talk about the ELIZA effect. And this was really when the gentleman Weizenbaum, I think it was, he really solved one of the AI issues early on, which was you had to have this ton of data in order for these systems to know what to do and work. And so he kind of said, well, what if you use the Socratic method? What if in interactions with individuals, you just pulled out keywords and fed them back?
Yes. Just keep asking the questions.
Yeah. Which we know. And has actually evolved into the 70s into kind of some self-help therapy stuff. There was some fall down parts with that. Now we're kind of back into that cycle. But what became known as the ELIZA effect was because ELIZA was the chatbot. What he noticed very quickly was when people would engage with the chatbot, they found that it was trustworthy faster than they would have in engagements with a human being. And so they gave a lot more information and they trusted the feedback. They started to, you know, kind of put human characteristics on the computer that the program likes me. It's interested in me, right? All of those things. And of course, it's ones and zeros in the background. Don't kid yourself. And so over time, he actually going from being the person who really kind of solved it, really became very public about humanity is not ready for this and we should not do it because people don't know how to separate the human experience from the computer experience. So when, and we've seen that, right? In social media, that's the problem with deep fakes. That's the problem. You see a picture, you see an image. Well, of course it should be true. Except now in the world of AI, it's not. And there are some very weighty ethical questions. What happens in a world where you can literally erase people from being on a public street? Like what happens in a world where you don't see the reality that is, and what happens where everything you see behind a computer screen isn't necessarily valid or trustworthy? What does that do to communication? What does that do to how we make decisions? There's a bunch of question marks. I'm not a fear monger, but I think we have to be smart as a people because it's here. We also have to be mindful to challenge our own assumptions and not suspend critical thinking. And one of the examples I love, and one of the reasons it stuck with me, and this is probably 7, 8, 9 years ago now, it had taken a body of data and put it into a machine and just fed it some assumptions and said, hey, you know, let's assume that herd of unicorns has been discovered in a previously, you know, undiscovered valley by some team, right? But it generated a very convincing what seemed to be a news article, right? Like mm-hmm. It named the valley, it named the professor, it gave him like the credentials. It talked about why these unicorns were never found before. And if you don't start with, there are no unicorns, you could have bought it, right? And so that's, I think, one of the things too, that when we talk about what are the risks, rewards, whether it's with image generation, image adjustments, or even just what we read daily, like the ability to take misinformation and publish it in 15 places and then redirect it to itself so it looks legit, like that's a nefarious problem.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah, I mean, even more than in the past, we're going to be looking for trusted sources for this stuff. And it's going to be, and like kind of what you're saying is kind of don't believe your eyes and your ears anymore or even anything that's written.
Meet the people for coffee. I think that's the other thing when we talk about what's the future coming. I think the power of the in-person meeting of like, you are who you say you are. You look like what you like. I think that becomes more valuable because the online avatars have just gotten so incredibly good, you know? So yeah, I always kind of talk about letting technology do what tech does best so people can do what people do best. And I think that separation comes back to critical thinking, building relationships, dreaming a little bit and solving real problems and being present. And I think that's going to be where the future power of this will be for individuals. It's going to be their time. It's going to be the value of their attention. But there is kind of a retraining in the computers are not the smartest. They might have the most information. They might be the most adept at dealing with the data.
Yes.
But don't confuse that with being the smartest person in the room. That's
right.
I maintain that's a human job.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very good. No, yeah, no, that's what humans are really good at is critical thinking and human interaction and emotions and all that type of stuff. I think you're right. That's still uniquely human and likely will be uniquely human, you know, forever. As part of this book that I was just listening to, what she said was interesting. It was like, you know, so humans are carbon-based, but all these computers are silicon-based. And so why are we actually trying to essentially recreate ourselves in a silicon-based environment? Like almost kind of question the reason as to like, why are we even doing this in some ways? And I was like running along thinking about that. Yeah, we're basically trying to take all the things that are human in some ways, and we're really trying to push it to the edge, right? We're trying to make artificial intelligence, you know, that is general artificial intelligence, right? And yeah. We're not satisfied with just kind of stopping with where we're at, which I think is fascinating.
Well, and I think the other piece is this blend between the carbon-based and the silicon-based, because there's some really interesting exploratory work in what do you do when you can think a thing and it translates into energy and sends out communications. I mean, it seems, you know, for those of us who are kind of like old Trekkies or Jetson folk or like really enjoyed sci-fi, it feels very like the Borg is now, you know, the future is now kind of sensation. And so I think that's an interesting question of, you know, kind of, okay, it's cool, but so what? Like, what does that look like at the end? And right. Man, I've had a couple of like times where I just had to stop myself because you start to wonder like, so what is uniquely human and how does work and economies look like in the future and how should it look? And do we know, like we might have the opportunity to really redefine our best future with a different set of rules, but we have to be smart about it, be super thoughtful and be well informed about the decisions we're making.
For sure. Well, one of the things I do like to ask people that have been on the show or that are on the show is like, you know, obviously you're just an experimenter. It sounds like, you know, you love to get in and start doing stuff. Tech hobbyist, I guess that's the word I was looking for. How would you recommend people? Like, is there anything in particular that you recommend people start to do? Are there, I don't know, books, classes, conferences? How would you frame that up?
Tons. Well, I think number one, if you're listening to this podcast because you're interested, if you're kind of a tech hobbyist like me, and that's a safe place to be, where you acknowledge you just don't know everything. Number one, create the space to learn. And I always recommend, find 25 or 30 minutes in your calendar or in your week and just decide to use a tool that's available. AI tools are showing up in any program. I mentioned, you know, it's baked into Messenger, it's baked into your Google Docs, it's baked into your Microsoft, it's baked into your Word search. Like, just try to use it. I think number two is periodically find yourself and surround yourself with people who know what you don't know. Like the Applied AI Conference in Minneapolis, St. Paul, I love it. But there's, you know, different conferences or events where you can literally just walk into a room. Sometimes we think, well, I don't know if that's for me. I don't know if I belong. I don't know if I know enough to get anything out of it. Go hang out with people who are smarter than you and go hang out with people who are doing stuff you're not doing and just be super curious. I think that's the second thing that's really valuable. And I think the third thing that's really important is these tools are most powerful and most interesting when you have a problem to solve. So when you get into a day and you think, man, I wish, then finish that sentence and literally go into like a ChatGPT or even a, you know, a search bar and just say, hey, how can AI help me solve this problem? And then find something to take action on. Be curious.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I was thinking about, you know, there's this new search engine called Perplexity. Not sure if you've toyed around with that, but, you know, they raised a bunch of money and everything like that. And they're trying to redefine, you know, how we search for stuff, which I do think the old Google search way of getting a bunch of resources and links is definitely a one track. You know, there's certain people are going to use that. But this Perplexity idea was like, why don't I start searching for stuff in Perplexity? And what I realized was just it created more of a dialogue. As I got done with stuff, it would actually suggest, well, here's some other things you might want to ask about. And so I found myself on there for like 20 minutes. You said, I love this idea of carving out time. Like, I want to solve this thing. And then you just kind of experiment and play around with it. And I found myself, I think I'm actually looking to train for my next marathon. And so I need ideas around like that. And I can certainly search for that on Google and find some blog that somebody wrote. But this was a really nice compact way. It kind of prompted me with other things that I might want to think about and ask. So just carving out time to try a new tool. I mean, I'll just say Perplexity was interesting. I don't know if, again, not sure if it's the best one I'm going to go to all the time for everything, but it was a fun experiment.
I think to your point, Justin, you know, the assumption that what is today is as good as it gets, is just not true. So Perplexity, and Perplexity has evolved over time. I love Perplexity. Claude, you know, has had some great work and some great impacts as well. I mean, there become more and more ways to use it. What I love about Perplexity specifically is it has rich responses, but I also like when I ask Perplexity, and this isn't related to the search bar, but in terms of information gathering, mm-hmm. Perplexity was one of the first that actually showed me where it got the information.
True.
Right. There's a lot there's a lot of chatbots where they're like, oh, here you go. And then I say, well, cite the sources. And they're like, well, that is out of scope. Well, that's not helpful. Did you just dream this up or whose name is on the byline, right? But I think as listeners kind of dabble with different solutions, you just become more aware of what's possible. And you also become a little bit more savvy about what works, what doesn't work in different situations. But I would also mention, you know, when you talk about training for a marathon, I've been fascinated with the GPT store launched with OpenAI. And so, you know, you're also seeing some of those just like chat helps of expertise, like I could see, Justin, your personal AI GPT running coach would be super interesting in that environment.
Well, so this is something I actually have been thinking about for the past week or so, is actually just blowing that out even further. So I haven't done much research on this, but I know people have been working on this. They've been working on it for years, or decades probably. But just this idea, so I write in a journal every morning, right? I wouldn't say I write every morning, but probably 95%+ of the time I'm actually writing in this thing. And a lot of it is just sort of random thoughts of things that I want to do, things that I have done. It's just a nice place for me to sort of dump content. But I was like, wow, what if, you know, all of this stuff got put into a large language model? And then, you know, boy, I'm just sort of thinking about legacy, right? 100 years from now, great, great, great grandchildren or whatever are able to then ask me questions about how my marathon was, right? And how did I train for it? And here's, you know, information. So boy, I definitely think that there is something there around just being able to train the large language model around your entire life, really. And it's gonna happen. It's definitely going to happen. But being able to train these things is becoming easier and easier, isn't it? Like there's a thing called Workbook. Boy, we just talked about it at our last meetup that Google has. Super easy for you just to point it at a Google Drive with a bunch of documents in it, and it will go ahead and pull it in. So it's fascinating.
I love that. Now, of course, you know what I'm doing directly after our conversation is learning that one, because I'm not as familiar with Workbook, but I love it.
Yeah, I was just going to try and look it up. Boy, I don't know why I'm spacing on. I will definitely include it in the links here, but it's just a tool that Google put out to allow you to, and again, it's sort of like, as long as you have a Google account, you can start playing around with it, start using it. So the other thing I was going to say is, you know, how do people get a hold of you? That's one of the probably a good next question.
Sure. I'm an open connector, so you can find me on LinkedIn. That's probably easiest. You can also find me through bluephoenixlearning.com, or my speaker website is donnaherbal.com. But reach out. I'm, you know, available. My contact's open. LinkedIn's probably best and easiest, or directly through the sites, or you'll see me around the horn at podcast conferences and events, just encouraging people to get curious and imagine the future and dabble in some tools and processes.
That's cool. Very, very good. Good. Is there anything else that maybe you wanted to talk about that we didn't really discuss here today?
I think, Justin, probably the biggest piece when it comes to applied AI, and you touched on it briefly, is where does this data go over time and how do we use it? I think there's something around organizational knowledge, right? Like the coming silver wave that a lot of legacy organizations have. You've got experts who are retiring and leaving your workforce. And there's a lot of concern around, man, how do we grow up this next set of legacy leaders? Well, you have a unique ability to pull that information, those avatars, those coaches out of people's heads before they leave. You know, is there a model where if a person was like, give me all the Donnaherbal good stuff so we can just source it on demand, do you just pay a subscription fee for that in my little magic GPT and I can be your hospitality helper because I've got that background? I don't know. Is there a Lab 651 like, hey, this is our expertise and you can subscribe to this mm-hmm. source of knowledge? Like, mm-hmm. I think that's an interesting question. I would like us to figure that out because I think that part is fascinating.
Yeah, for sure. And we haven't been able to really do it much, you know, and it's been, again, it's becoming easier and easier for us to get this information, A, and then B, be able to build these systems. And I was wrong with a workbook. It's Notebook. So Google Notebook. Google Notebook LM, and you'll find it. And I'll be sure to put a link to it in our liner notes here. It makes it super easy for people. Again, it's this idea of kind of building GPTs based off of, you know, notes. But I think what's interesting is, you know, it's kind of integrated into the Google ecosystem, which is where all this is going, right? So we're a G Suite company. I've been using G Suite for forever, since even before it even launched. And so, you know, Google can I just turn this thing on, right? And so it'll allow you to be able to kind of crawl over all your documents. Now, there's the privacy question, and am I okay with Google having all this stuff? And believe me, they already do have it all anyways. But again, it's a fun sort of tool. So yeah, take a look at Notebook LM. Well, that's great. We've talked around a lot of different things, and there's so many new things that come out. I mean, this is the beauty of this field, I think, is literally every day I learn about something new. There's some sort of new tool. And sometimes I remember the name and sometimes I get the name wrong, but there's always new stuff that people are doing. And most of these things too, I would say, they kind of have a freemium model, right? You can generate images and they're watermarked or whatever. And if you think it's worthwhile, then start paying the subscription for it. You know, you can use ChatGPT and it might time out and yada, 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 but you get a sense for what it is. If you think it's useful, then you can pay for the full version. There's all sorts of easy ways for people to sign up and start playing around with it. And I mean, it's just every day I'm like, I wonder if there's an AI tool for X, and I search for it and I find it.
And there it is. I love
it. Yeah, exactly. Well, great. Great, Donna. I appreciate the time today. It's been a lot of fun, and you know, good luck with all your work that you're doing. You know, we actually didn't get a chance to talk too much about Savvy, but I should have you back on to talk about health insurance specifically. We could talk another hour on that, I'm sure.
I would love to do it. Yeah, let's talk about how AI helps us solve our most complex challenges and problems easily for the end user. That's a follow-up. Justin, thank you so much. This has been a gift.
You've listened to another episode of the Conversations on Applied AI podcast. We hope you are eager to learn more about applying artificial intelligence and deep learning within your organization. You can visit us at appliedai.mn to keep up to date on our events and connect with our amazing community. Please don't hesitate to reach out to Justin at appliedai.mn if you are interested in participating in a future episode. Thank you for listening.